From all corners of the globe to your ears, it's the Midnight Movie Cowboys. Sometimes informative, sometimes controversial, but always unpredictable. It's the Midnight Movie Cowboys podcast with your hosts, Hunter, John, and Stu. And now, on with the show.
Hello, everyone, and welcome to another edition of the Midnight Movie Cowboys podcast. I'm Hunter Deusing down in Dallas, Texas, and joining me out in the wild outback of Australia is Mr. Stuart Bulk. Say hello, Stu.
Hello, with a cold.
And up in the snowy hell, the white hell of Denver, Colorado, we have Mr. John Grace. Say hello, John.
Hello from the wet, snowy range this week that's supposed to be spring break.
Yeah. Oh, it's spring break for you guys.
Yeah, I actually took a couple of days off to kind of goof off, and no, it's rotten weather, and it's miserable.
That stinks.
Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah, we had our spring break a couple weeks ago. It was nice. It's good.
Because it's Texas.
Yeah,
You don't get this goddamn snow all the time.
So this week, the movie we're looking at is, we're doing another Hammer movie, guys.
Yep.
Right? Hammer. Gothic yep. Horror. We're doing Frankenstein Created Woman. A reference to Vadim's and God Created Woman. And, yeah, so had you guys seen this movie before? Is this your first time seeing it?
I saw it when I was like 8 years old or 9 years old on WTBS. On a Friday night broadcast.
But you still.
No, never seen it before. I've owned it for a little while in my Big Hammer Blu-ray box set, but was not one of the ones I went to. Immediately, unlike Rasputin the Mad Monk and Dracula Prince of Darkness, which is in that same box set. But no, never seen it before.
Yeah, I've got, I have a Hammer 3-pack. It's got that on DVD plus Dracula Prince of Darkness and what was the
Legend name? Legend of the Seven Golden Vampires
the Shaw Brothers collaboration.
That is from a release, because I have that same release, and that I bought it at Target for like $10, and that was from a company that like went out of business as soon as they released that. They were going to release all the Studio Canal Hammer remasters on home video here, and then they went under.
Crash Cinema.
this was Millennium Entertainment or something, and I thought it was a offshoot of Millennium Pictures, but apparently that's not the case.
Hey, honey, we should check if John had done it.
It would have been like Legend of the Seven Crippled Vampires, or something.
Right, Seven Venoms.
We should check if John and Garrow renamed Frankenstein Created Woman from its original title. They probably did.
Yeah, it was originally called Frankenstein.
Ho brought back from the dead.
Yeah, that'd be Garrow.
Try to get that Wu-Tang audience.
Yeah.
Hey, yo, I got that. I got that. That Ho brought back from the dead DVD at the play back at the crib.
Ghostface Ho brought back from the dead.
Frankenstein Created Thought.
Yo, I got that. I got that back at the crib. It's a good one. It's a good one. Hey, that guy in the background there, he was in Mad Monkey Kung Fu.
I may have to get a ticket for the RZA presenting 36 Chambers of Shaolin live at the Paramount Theater. He's gonna
don't miss that. That'll be good.
Yeah, I need to get a ticket. That might be interesting.
Oh, just real quick, before we launch into this film, John, can you give us like a 5-minute breakdown of your dinner with Jell-O Biafra?
Well, I want to do it.
Okay. John, for those of you who are not in our Facebook group, may not be aware, John was hanging out with James Ellroy and Jell-O Biafra recently.
Well, what happened was
Corporations.
Eddie Muller was having a Noir City presentation or Noir Alley. I don't have TCM, so I don't know what his show is called on there, but he was hosting some screenings of film noir movies, and Jell-O Biafra, whose mother still lives in Boulder, flew in to see some of the films, and James Ellroy was co-hosting it with Eddie Muller because they're friends, and I guess Ellroy has gone to San Francisco and hosted the screenings there with Eddie Muller. And So I'm hanging out with James Ellroy and Eddie Muller and the fans of the Here Comes Jell-O Biafra, and sits down next to Ellroy, and it's kind of a weird... It's one of those things where it's like nobody seems to recognize Jell-O.
Well, yeah, because a lot of people I don't think know what he looks like. You know, they just know his voice.
Yeah, I recognize him right away because I'd seen him before at the Zola RX show when they opened for Thor, and Jell-O was kind of managing them and was goofing off with Thor and everything. So I knew what he looked like and know his voice like right away. And
even though like Jell-O is like kind of an Antifa tier leftist, by all accounts he's a pretty cool dude. Like he's not, you know.
Yeah.
He's not a jerk. Yeah.
Yeah, and he's not gonna pull any loudmouth left wing stuff like in front of somebody like James Ellroy or anything. And what good is he gonna do? Really. And then the next night, after the screenings, James Ellroy took Eddie Muller to the airport, and I was at the Alamo, and I just said to Jell-O, I thanked him for the Zolar X release. And then he just started telling me all this stuff about releasing that and stories about the band. And by the way, I do recommend that is like, if you buy one CD from Alternative Tentacles, make it the Zolar X CD. It's amazing. And, I talked to him and he kind of filled me in on a lot of old, punk rock trivia. Cause I was asking him all these obscure questions about, esoteric stuff about the punk rock scene of the 70s and early 80s. I know a lot about it and everything. And then, one of his friends was like, hey, let's see about getting a drink. And he invited me to have a beer with him. So just went in there and we all kind of hung out. And I talked to him for about 2 hours and just pretty nice guy. As long as
why don't you come have a beer with me.
Yeah. Hey, the bar's still open.
The bar's still open.
You guys want to have a drink, you know? And then the friend of mine who was there with me, he's also a friend of Elroy's. He had to work in the morning, like pretty early, so he couldn't do it. So it's like, well, I guess I'll have a beer with Jell-O, and the pets at home can wait for their food. I'll have a story to tell on the podcast. So I haven't really listened to the Dead Kennedys.
When Jell-O Biafra tells you to have a drink, you have a drink.
Yeah.
You know what
I mean? Come on, I'm not going to turn down a drink from Jell-O Biafra, even though he's. That would be insane.
Jell-O Biafra and I would agree on pretty much nothing, and I would say absolutely.
Yeah, and I figure, well, you know, he's probably not going to talk about politics and shit because I don't really want to hear it and everything, and he'll probably just talk about music and record collecting.
That's his Alice Cooper bit, you know.
Right.
That's his Kiss bit. He's the political guy. He gets up there and does California Uber Alice, but with Schwarzenegger.
Right. I mean,
like here's the. Thing, the Melvin he does albums with the Melvins. The Melvins are libertarians, like they read Thomas Sowell.
From what I heard, Buzz King Buzzo is actually pretty conservative. He just says he's libertarian in interviews, but he was at some of the Breitbart secret meetings or something in LA.
Yeah, so. Yeah. You can kind of say you're libertarian, and like leftists won't like. Completely hit you,
John.
Yeah.
Did he do a rendition of Colorado Uber Alice?
No. He's it's well. I mean, Colorado's pretty much gone blue. Mm. Like Trump did not win the state, and we have a bunch of liberals from California moved out here, and they've kind of changed the voting.
It's Californication, man.
Yeah, you know, because they basically tax themselves out of living in their own home state that they moved to ours and fuck it up.
That's what they do. That's what they do in Texas.
What about a rendition of Holiday in Colorado?
Well,
Colorado, John Grace.
It's you'll work hard with a gun in your back and a bowl of weed a day.
Isn't that everything that he kind of acts like capitalism does exactly what communism does to people that it rules over? It's like, and this is what you get for asking questions. You know, it's like,
well, that's like Father Coughlin. You know,
pretty much. But you know, he didn't discuss politics. It's like I've noticed like once you connect with their offstage persona, they don't get into the stuff that's so annoying about their onstage routine or character. And yeah, he's fine. He's a pretty interesting guy. He's funny. You know, it was cool to talk to him.
When you met him, did he say, "Sieg howdy"?
No.
Okay.
Because I don't go saying, oh yeah, I'm buddies with Elroy because we're both of the same politic, because we're pretty much the only people in that room with that belief. So,
but I think Jello would have known Elroy's political leanings anyway.
I think he does.
He doesn't.
So he didn't really bring it up, because Jello would bring up a criminal from the 70s who ended up, you know, like a serial killer who got shot by the cops. So then Elroy would go, well, at least it had a happy ending. So, yeah, I think he knew what, he wasn't going to get any of this Save Mumia type shit from Elroy. Okay. So
I would have asked Jello. I really would have asked Jello about his political run he went for. He did in 1980 against Dianne Feinstein. I think it was.
Oh, you can look that up on YouTube.
I'd vote for Jell-O over Dianne Feinstein. Oh,
yeah.
Would have been interesting, though, just to
at least Jell-O's against Jerry Brown. That guy sucks.
Well, I think he did some Save the Redwoods protests with Jerry Brown, because, you know, it's funny, like, they started doing marches together in the 90s because Jerry Brown became a radio host for a while. And everybody, including my liberal relatives will say, oh, you know, on the radio, Jerry's like this great guy, and then he runs for office and he's horrible. You know, like on talk radio, he's perfectly normal and sensible, and then he actually wins an election, and he's just goes back to being the horrible politician everybody hated.
Well, it's kind of like it's like that with everybody. It's like they all of a sudden get all these tentacles in their ear, you know, like with Donald Trump's spending bill, it's horrible, you know. You know, like a lot of people are mad at Trump. A lot of his base is mad because this new spending bill is enormous and it has none of the stuff that he promised, you know. So it's one of those things.
Well, luckily, it is an allocation. So it's not like he's going to go spend this money. It's like, okay, you know, it was kind of a technical glitch. And of course, everybody like Ann Coulter starts throwing bombs because that's what they do. That's their whole thing.
That's their thing, is to push the conversation, you know.
Yeah, she's never going to be happy with anything 100% anyway. She always has to have a turning point. And, you know, I remember when she was campaigning hard for Mitt Romney back when John McCain got the nomination. Some of us have been around a while. We remember these things. But Jell-O was he's a lot of fun to talk to, and really interesting and cool stories. And he talked about when he went to see Black Sabbath. They were like the fourth on the bill with all these other big groups of the time. And they actually said Boston was the opening act, and nobody had heard them back then. And he said that suddenly all the lights go off and they hear this announcement, ladies and gentlemen, the future of rock and roll, Heart. And he said he and his buddy were just like, no. So he's pretty funny, and you know, tell like these stories and everything.
Women, stay out of rock and roll.
It's like corporations pushing women, and you know. But he just said they were just dreadful. He told me his least favorite bands, and he's explained some of this stuff. If you go on YouTube, there's
hold up.
Yeah,
what are some of Jell-O Biafra's least favorite bands?
The Eagles.
I can see that.
Yes,
not the Eagles of death metal. Oh
no,
yes!
No, the Eagles. Yes, he hates. Yes, he did. However, when it comes to the Eagles, he does love the Glenn Frey song "The Heat Is On."
Of course,
yeah, he loves that song. He's that's a great song.
Great song, of course.
And Grateful Dead is another band he hates.
Good.
Yeah. Beach Boys. He said although he respects Brian Wilson, he hates the Beach Boys.
I like the Beach Boys.
I like them too. I don't mind them. So. I can't remember the other bands. But I know he really hated Yes. And the Four Seasons. He hates Frankie Valli.
I don't know. I love Yes personally.
I like some of the early Yes when they were a psych pop band. Yeah. But when they go prog, they get
prog poofda. That's why.
Yeah.
I love that stuff. I don't know.
Yeah, but he, you know, he we were talking. He said he's never seen Saturday Night Live, and the Dead Kennedys were invited to play on there. John Belushi wanted to get him on, but the NBC executive says not with that name. They're not getting on this show, so they got. And he said that, you know, he's never seen Saturday Night Live. He goes, I grew up on Laugh-In, That's what I know is Laugh-In was my TV comedy, and he never watched SNL. And then he also said that Jimmy Carter, he said this before in interviews, by the way, this is not new info. Jimmy Carter had a meeting with all the record companies in like 1978 and said, no punk rock, do not sign punk rock acts. We don't want another 60s.
He said, within weeks, reason to hate Jimmy Carter.
And he said within weeks, all the punk bands that were being courted by the majors lost their deals. They were just dropped. And he said the Saints, they were supposed to, Sire was supposed to release the Saints' third record. They never did. And he said just all of a sudden within like a month, everybody lost their deals except for the Dickies. And he says just because the lead singer, Leonard, I think he had a relative who worked for A&M. And that's the, these were the only ones who got to keep their deal. So,
yeah, but take some.
but yeah, it there wasn't a lot of like you know, incredible secret info or anything. But he was good to talk to. So I can now say I've had a beer with Jell-O Biafra.
Too bad you didn't eat with Jell-O Biafra. You could have called him Fork Boy.
Well, I was just trying to hold back on doing my impression of him. Corporations suck. You know, I wanted to say it so bad, but you know, but he never got political.
Bush regime.
Yeah, briefly he said something about because one of the guys there asked him about if he was watching the Stormy Daniels interview, and he said, "Oh, I'll read a recap of it later this week." And he said, "Oh, just wait till they find out all the mafia people he built casinos with." And I'm like, "Boy, if that's your big." You know, your big thing, it's over. You guys don't have anything.
Yeah. You know, you should have said to him, if you believe that thing, you must be a drug-sniffing dog. Well, these are some loud references
machine,
people won't get.
Conformist. Yeah. You know.
Yeah.
But, conformity!
Right. But he's he talked about, you know, his record, the way he listens to records. He's a big vinyl guy. It's not an Eddie Trunk.
Well, like, he was the... So I got a CD in my car. had to do the bit.
It sounded like Eddie Trunk when he was about
70.
The guy
who was pushing Death, the not the death metal band, but the, you know, Detroit black proto punk band. He came across their "Corporations in My Eyes" single, and he was one of the guys who kind of put that out there and said, "Hey, this is really cool."
Yeah, he's really important for that whole, you know, kind of lost, obscure garage glam punk. Acts that could have been a big thing in, you know, in the 70s had they been signed and people paid attention to them, like Zolar X, I thought could have been huge, but you know, there's always personal issues. There are reasons they never make it, and if you watch a documentary about the band called Death, you'll see that, you know, there's a lot of reasons they didn't make it big.
Yeah there's plenty. Yeah
I mean, even when we talked about the Thor documentary, I mean, there's reasons they don't get bigger. You know, even though it seems to all be there, but there's that one thing missing, you know. Like, I asked him about the band Crime, which was San Francisco's first punk band. And he said, well, the problem with Crime is they were absolutely horrible to other bands. Like, they really were, like, criminals. Like, they were said to finance recordings by sticking up liquor stores and stuff, so...
they're like the siege of bands.
Yeah, no, Crime was bad news. Like, he said they were really awful people. And he admitted, he goes, we used our own political correctness to stop them from playing gigs because they were so mean, so.
Didn't you guys actually like Lard? Or was it just me?
I think I may have listened to it once or twice. It just, yeah. You know. I don't even find listening to the Dead Kennedys to be that all that interesting these days. You know, yeah, Holiday in Cambodia is a great song. And, you know.
I think their first album, I only listen to their first album. Everything after
Rotting
that.
Fresh Vegetables, kind of, right?
Yeah, that's Fresh Fruit's a good album.
Fresh
yeah.
Fruit for Rotting Vegetables.
That's a good album. That's a really, it's basically a great album. If I'm listening to
DK, that's what I'm listening to.
Exactly. And then the other stuff, there's good tunes, in, I think, in some of the other records, but it's like, it's so dated, though, you know, it's because it's very of its time.
Yeah, like, you know, my introduction to the Dead Kennedys was Police Truck on the Tony Hawk Pro Skater soundtrack, which I think Jell-O was pretty upset that the band licensed that. But that's how my generation got into the Dead Kennedys, was hearing that song in Tony Hawk Pro Skater. So,
yeah. Well, I had always heard MTV Get Off the Air, which was really just a rant set to
Hi,
me.
I'm your MTV VJ. I sound like I'm way on Quaaludes.
He was totally dead on. I mean, that's a timeless piece right there.
Yeah, it is.
Because I hate MTV. I think they did a lot of damage to the music industry, even though they get all this credit for saving it, but they really destroyed it.
MTV, get off the air!
Yeah, and you know, there's some good stuff there and everything, but they're very of their time. And of course, the ugly lawsuit he had with his bandmates, and he was found to be at fault or whatever it is. So, and he didn't say anything negative about his old bandmates, though.
No.
You know, so he lost that case, and you know, I guess pays out the royalties regular. Or they have the rights to the band or something. I forget what the whole thing with that is.
All right.
Yeah, I think they've got a lot of it. But anyway, Frankenstein created. So let's get into the first transgender Frankenstein movie.
Okay. Anybody?
Yeah. No. I don't know.
Which one? So
it could be totally remarketed with that nowadays.
Yeah. No. Yeah, it could. You know, and it wasn't something I noticed the first time I watched it, but then I kind of noticed it this time. But I don't think it was that was really the thing. I mean, I think it was just kind of a new take because this was the fourth movie in the Hammer Frankenstein series, 1967, directed by Terrence Fisher, written by Anthony Hines, writing under the name John Elder. And he wrote a bunch of Hammer movies. This one came after. So, like, I really, you know, just totally changing thoughts here for a second in the middle of the sentence. I love the Hammer Frankenstein movies because, you know, Peter Cushing's my favorite Dr. Frankenstein. And but what I like about the Frankenstein movies is that they focus on Dr. Frankenstein. The monster is barely a part of it, almost. Yeah. I mean, it is, but it's not, like, the focus. You would not be confused as to who Frankenstein is by watching these. And first movie was really good, and but the second one, you know, it was Frankenstein swapping out brains. He wasn't like cutting up bodies and assembling corpses. The third movie was, I think, Universal distributed it, so they kind of went more of a Universal route with it. But this one, what I think is so interesting about this is one of my favorites of the Frankenstein series, along with Frankenstein Must Be Destroyed. I like it. I think it's really interesting because Frankenstein's not so much preoccupied with reanimating dead flesh as he is with the soul. Mm. You know, and it kind of adds another sci-fi dimension to it. And it's really weird and not very well explained, but it doesn't really need to be in the movie.
Right.
So, you know, it's what it is Dr. Frankenstein basically kind of discovers that you can die and save the soul, and one of his assistants is killed in a conflict with cane twirling Chads, and he's not killed. He's executed as if he's framed for murder by cane twirling Chads, and the assistant's girlfriend, who's deformed, commits suicide when this happens, and
suicide by jumping into a pond. Yeah, okay, no worries.
Yeah.
Only in a Hammer film.
We'll yeah.
Do that.
So you know, he transfers the soul of his dead assistant into the body of his girlfriend. So you have it's almost like you know the two lovers become one in this body, and he puts his soul into her body, and then she goes to get revenge on the cane twirling Chads. And, you know, it goes from there. But, you know, it's a pretty wild movie. So what were some impressions that you had on it, Stu? So this is your first time seeing it.
Okay. So I sat down, I watched it, I'm watching it, I'm 45 minutes in, which is about the halfway mark. And I said, boy, this first half better make sense in the second half, cause I'm really not getting what's going on here. But, yeah, thankfully it did. So it was, yeah, it was all good. But, yeah, it was, nicely paced, I should say, for its 92 minutes.
Yeah, I think it's really brisk. It's a really quick, good pulpy watch. You know, I didn't, yeah. I thought it,
you know, it like a Hammer movie. It kind of its scenes are kind of stagey and played out, but they're really well directed by Fisher, who's kind of the Hammer director. John, what were some thoughts revisiting it for you?
I was kind of this is my first time to watch it with like a time monitor on the Blu-ray player, so I was kind of like, oh wow, it really doesn't get to all the crazy like the horror elements until like the last half hour. Like everything's in that third act. Everything, like first hour is kind of like just a build up to what happens later on. And I'm wondering if it really warped audiences back in the 60s, like to be dragged out like that. But I don't know if the Hammer films had that type of following back then. I don't know if they were just seen as horror movies coming out or people really viewed them as, oh, it's the new Hammer movie. But maybe they did have that rep. I don't know.
Would this have been around the peak?
I don't know what the viewpoint was at the time. What were you about to say, Steve?
Would this have been around the peak of Hammer's popularity in 1966?
Yeah, I would say the 60s. The early ones in the 50s were like monster hits. Like literally, like Curse of Frankenstein and Horror of Dracula were massive hits for Warner Brothers. But different studios handled different Hammer films throughout the 60s. I guess because of the production deals they made. Well, so.
And that's why you're never going to get them all in one big Blu-ray box set. You know,
right.
They're all kind of dispersed around the home video ecosystem.
Yeah, which does remind me of a funny Jell-O Biafra joke, because they were asking him about the election back in 2004. And he told the reporter something like, you know, he didn't like Bush, of course, Republican, but then he was making fun of John Kerry going, it's too bad Hammer isn't around casting Dracula to replace Christopher Lee, because John Kerry would be perfect. It's just, you know, it's pretty even-handed back then. So, but yeah, I it's funny because Hammer fandom is so fanatical. If you find you talk to these middle-aged old guys who like read Little Shop of Horrors and scenes like that, and I think that started maybe in the 60s, and you know, they're very fanatical for these films, and I'm sure they were all plagued with those rumors that there were harder versions released in Japan or France or whatever. And I don't know if that was really the case. Supposedly with Horror of Dracula, it was. There's a little more gore in the, you know, it's probably 5 seconds worth in the Japanese version. But the idea of a Hammer film, I don't know if that was really a thing until maybe the 70s when these were seen on syndicated television and were pretty much dead in theaters. Because, you know... cinema had gone to like The Exorcist and Texas Chainsaw Massacre, and so the Hammer stuff looks really quaint and childish, you know, to audiences back then.
Okay. They were considered pretty gory for their time, though. I mean,
oh yeah,
like, you know, you read reviews and they kind of go, "Oh, these movies are gross. They're disgusting. You know, they're gory."
Right. Well, also they were heavier with the sex, the implications of sex, like in this film where he's sleeping with his scarred girlfriend. You know, that was pretty raunchy for a 67 and a movie that was probably mainly going to be seen by kids.
I tell you, when I first saw that woman, Susan Denberg, who played the Christina character in this, I really thought it was two different women. Once you saw her as scarred up with the dark hair, and then you see her later on with the blonde hair and, you know, minus the scar, I thought, oh, it looks like two different women, but it's the same one.
Yeah.
Oh, boy, yeah, what a good looking
Her real name
well.
Is... Her real name is Detlinde Zickner.
Yeah,
well, she was Polish.
She's from Germany, and she
was dubbed.
Yeah, she was a
Polish.
Yeah, she was a Playboy model.
Mm, yeah, right. I just saw some pictures. And, I'm like, ooh, boy. Yeah.
Mm.
Yeah.
And
very easy.
You know, I think when they made the movie, I think they even had like a birthday bash for it at the Playboy clubs or something. But they, you know, she was also in the Star Trek episode Mudd's Women.
Yep.
She was in that one. But, you know, it was funny. I was reading the Turner Classic Movies article about this movie. And it said that she, you know, basically was, you know, the success eluded her. And, you know, people were only interested in her physicality. And she eventually died of a drug overdose. But apparently that's not true.
No, she's
apparently
still alive.
She's still alive. No.
Yeah,
I remember when those rumors about her dying of an OD were established, and like that was the bio on her. And it turns out years later, it was revealed in some magazines, no, she's alive and living in Europe. She just had to leave Hollywood because the whole swinging 60s of sex and drugs wasn't good for her. She didn't handle it well.
No, she had mental health problems.
And she wasn't really taken seriously. I mean, in this movie, she's dubbed. You know,
yeah, she's dubbed by the same woman that dubs Ursula Andress in all the 60s films, like Dr. No, and dubbed a lot of voices in all the early James Bond movies, like dubbed all the way.
And dubbed Gina Carano in Haywire.
that was the great Laura San Giacomo.
Mm.
Although some people, I think Zolly thinks it's Kate Winslet, but I think it's Laura San Giacomo. Because I watch a bunch of episodes of Just Shoot Me, and I'm like, well, that's Gina Carano's voice in Haywire right there.
You know, when I was watching this, I thought Peter Cushing was great, as always.
I thought he was great, and I thought his assistant was really good, as sort of the drunken, the alcoholic assistant. You know, he's sort of the Igor stand-in, I guess.
Yeah, but not like the old hunchback, you know, one-eyed Igor sort of thing.
No, he's just a drunk, you know.
They never had like the hunchback or whatever. They didn't go real broad like the Universals did.
He's got the assistant, but it's never the deformed freak.
Like the
but
Marty Feldman
guy, this guy's deformity is alcoholism, you know.
Yeah, that's right. But what I was thinking was, when I saw Peter Cushing in this, I mean, he's done that many films with Hammer and other ones as well, that a lot of the younger ones remember him from Star Wars, the first one, or number four.
Right.
But that seems to be like a real blight on his career, that does. Like a real shit stain on his filmography, which is very vast. I just want to get your thoughts on him being in Star. I think I heard as well Peter Cushing was like, oh, I'll do it, but he didn't really like it. He got sick of people asking him about Star Wars.
Well, that's like Alec Guinness, same way. I mean, you know, a lot of these actors Lucas cast because he loved their work. Like Lucas was a big Hammer fan. You know, that's why he cast Christopher Lee as Count Dooku, right? To kind of keep the Hammer theme going. But yeah, a lot of these actors, you know, like Alec Guinness would have preferred to talk about, you know, his Shakespeare work or his David Lean films. He didn't really care much for Star Wars. He thought it was kind of kid stuff. And so did Peter Cushing. I'm sure Peter Cushing didn't live too much longer after Star Wars, but, now his corpse is being reanimated by computers for Rogue One and stuff like that.
No,
but,
don't know how I feel about that.
I don't like it. I think that's kind of weird territory.
It's tacky. You know,
I saw Last Jedi at the stores yesterday when I was out. I'm like, nope, don't want it. No, don't want it on the shelf. Even the kids asked for it. It's like, no, don't need it on there.
Yeah.
And I haven't even seen it, but I've just gone by just the mountain of horrible reviews and, you know,
oh, it's awful.
Vile hate I've heard about it. It's like, ugh.
It's amazing how bad. I did not. I mean, you know, I thought there was stuff to enjoy in The Force Awakens. There's nothing in this movie.
Yeah.
It was just bad. But I do think though that with the Lucas Star Wars, you know, I do think though that it does lead some fans that are not where Star Wars isn't their world to, you know, they do see the Hammer stuff and appreciate it. I mean, because I definitely, you know, saw Peter Cushing to me was Grand Moff Tarkin when I was a kid. And then when I discovered the Hammer movies, I was like, oh man, there's so much more to this guy, you know. I don't think it's totally a blight, but I do think that he has I do think it kind of leads people to other things, you know, because it definitely led me to other things with Peter Cushing. You know, he you find out, oh, he was Sherlock Holmes, he's Doctor Who, he was he was Dr. Van Helsing, he was Dr. Frankenstein. You know, this guy just had such a great career and was so charismatic, and in this movie I think he's fantastic. You know, whenever he comes into a scene, he commands your attention.
I actually believe I was watching Baron Frankenstein. Not for once did I sit there and think, oh, Peter Cushing.
Yeah, me too. I mean, I think to me, like, you know, I'm working on a book on Frankenstein films right now, and, you know, very slowly working on one. But to me, the Peter Cushing ones, that he is he is Baron Frankenstein. You know, he is the actor who owns this role, in my opinion. You know, other people have done it well, like Colin Clive, but you know, to me, he is the definitive Dr. Frankenstein. And these, the Hammer movies, I think they always took the Frankenstein myth in interesting directions. And this one is one of those where it's very metaphysical with the, you know, with Dr. Frankenstein becoming interested in the soul. How do I capture the soul? And it's very, you know, it doesn't really make a lot of sense, but it doesn't really need to, you know, you can just sort of, the movie is good enough to where you can just kind of go with it.
Well, did you notice the one really interesting character moment that was probably improvised by Cushing for the character in the scene? Mm-hmm. Was in the courtroom scene, he's flipping through a Bible condescendingly.
Yes. I noticed that. I thought that was great.
That was the first time I noticed that watching it, and I was just like, wow, you know, it's like the things you notice watching these in high def. I was like, oh, you know, that, I wonder if he just improvised that on the set or something, but he was just kind of flipping through it like he was.
And Peter Cushing's Frankenstein is an evil man. He's not the thing about, he's the protagonist in all of these movies, but he's not a good person. He's not like Colin Clive's Frankenstein where he's sympathetic. He is an evil person, and he only cares about his experiments and the cost of others be damned. You know, he's a little more sympathetic in this one because he does try to save characters in it.
Right.
But like Frankenstein must be destroyed. I mean, he's a killer. He's like wearing a mask and beheading people and stuff like
that. Yeah. They shot a scene in Frankenstein Must Be Destroyed where he raped Veronica Carlson or her character. And, that scene was hardly ever seen in any print, and then it played on WTBS in the 80s, and it was there Saturday morning broadcast. There was that scene that had been, people didn't even know it existed or something. It freaked everybody out. Now it's on all the video prints, but it was added in for the foreign markets to make the character more evil, and Peter Cushing hated the scene and didn't want it in the final cut. And Veronica Carlson said, yeah, he didn't like filming that scene because it was just, you know, he didn't like doing that. It offended
him. It's like Ronald Reagan when he did The Killers. He was like, I have to hit a woman.
Yeah.
I don't like that.
Supposedly he backed down Lee Marvin on the set because Lee Marvin was acting like an ass as usual. And Reagan, like, you know,
Reagan was a total Chad, you know.
Yeah, he was a big dude. He was a big, big, scary dude. And Marvin couldn't hang. And, well, Marvin also got knocked out by Roger Moore on the set of Shout at the Devil. So he seemed to have a problem with all of his co-stars. The most interesting aspect of this movie is when I was a kid and I was buying like monster magazines and books about horror movies that I could barely read. So I could just look at the photos, and they'd always print the lobby cards and the publicity stills. There were all these publicity stills of a Susan Denberg wearing some sort of bikini and Dr. Frankenstein, like, you know, Cushing putting her into the lab equipment or whatever. And
yes,
this scene is never in the movie.
No, it's not. It should have been.
It's like, God, it's a great image.
With the advertising, they really amped up the sort of sexy monster angle.
Yeah.
Like she's a, you know, you see her midriff, you know, she's a sexy monster. He created woman. It's kind of playing on the Roger Vadim and God Created Woman stuff. Because
yeah,
Roger Vadim for very
she's
sexy.
She's smoking hot in the photos, and it's like, no, that scene's never in the movie. It's like, man.
Yeah, no, she's very kind of Victorian dressed. You know, she's very conservative in her dress in the movie. It's it does not have the posters for this movie and the advertising for it makes it look like it's a very sexy movie, and it's not at all. Yeah. I mean, it has like the sort of you know, scandalous stuff with like the couple, you know, sleeping together out of wedlock and stuff, but it's not a movie that shows a lot of skin. And you know, Hammer movies were not shy about that. You know, they had lots of busty women in their movies, but this was this is not one of those Hammer movies.
Have you guys got the Blu-ray of this title?
No.
I've got it on DVD. The Blu-ray goes for like $50 here. It's pretty, you know.
Oh,
it's out of print, yeah.
Oh, okay. Because on the Blu-ray, there's actually a 45-minute documentary called Hammer Glamour, which is about all the women in the Hammer films. And they, get a few of them together and talk about their time with the hammer. It's actually an interesting watch. I only watched about 20 minutes of it, but yeah, it's a good watch if you can get the Blu-ray. If it's on the Blu-ray in the US, I don't know.
I don't even think it made it to Blu-ray in the US. I think
it
there
did.
Was.
I think it did.
Was it an Anchor Bay? Because I know there's a Brit in England. Yeah. I think it was part of a box set. I know in Australia they got a Blu-ray release, and I think in our money it's like $25 or something to import.
No, not anymore. That Blu-ray.
Hey, let me look. I'm pretty sure
gone.
It came. Okay, yeah, it did come out here. You got to pay $40 for it. I was mistaken.
Was it an Anchor Bay Blu-ray or something? Or?
Yeah, I think so. Let me.
Because Anchor Bay had the title for a while, and I used to have the standard. I think the standard DVD, which was, 1999 DVD and didn't look all that great.
It's Region A. It's from Millennium. I don't know.
Oh, they must have put it out and then went out of business.
Yeah, because
collectibles.
It has the Hammer Glamour segment on it, though.
Oh,
it's a brand new documentary, Hammer Glamour. It says commentary with Derek Folds, Robert Morris, Jonathan Rigby. The trailer, World of Hammer episode, The Curse of Frankenstein, World of Hammer episode, Hammer stars Peter Cushing, Hammer Glamour, animated stills, and collectible cards. So, yeah, there was a Blu-ray release. It's just, you got to pay a little bit for it.
That was like blink of an eye because that company went out of business almost as soon as this was out. Like within months. So, fuck. So, get the Australian import, I guess.
No, it's gone. That box, it's gone.
You could still buy it separately, I think, right?
No, so what they did was they had the first 11 or 12 titles out. Mm-hmm. You could buy them separately. Then they collated them into a box, which is what I got for, under $50, I think it was on the sale, which came with the 11 films and the two-disc DVD of the World of Hammer TV series in there as well. That box set went, then they updated it to the previous films, the two-disc Hammer series, and another four titles in there, Curse of the Werewolf, Brides of Dracula, Sherlock Holmes, and Captain Cronus. That box set, I now believe, is gone, so I don't know if they're going to update it again. I'm not too sure. But
let me correct something I said earlier. I said it goes for $40. You can get the Australian release standalone. It's Region A, B, and C, so you can get it, but it's $40. The one from Millennium goes for $60,
okay,
with tax. So that one, it says see all buy, so it's out of print. But yeah, anyway, correcting what I said earlier when I said it was $40. So that's not correct. It's $60.
Probably your best bet's going to be the UK, I'd imagine.
Or you can get it for super cheap on DVD, like I did. With other movies on a set.
Yep. But, they also released a whole bunch of other... Oh, no, here we are. It is still available here. Blu-ray DVD, Frankenstein Created Woman, $7.98. Okay, you still can't get it. My mistake.
Okay.
I'll put a link to this if you want to buy it from the Australia. That makes sense. From Australia. I believe it's going to be region free.
Yeah, it's Region A, B, and C.
And it's probably the Studio Canal recent remaster, same one that was used.
It is. But looking at the specs on the Millennium one, it's only got a low bitrate and just Dolby Digital 192, whereas the Australian one's got a very high bitrate and it's in fully uncompressed LPCM audio. So... yeah, I dare say go for the Australian release there. Don't try and seek out the American one. Although, I did notice that Taste of Blood of Dracula and Dracula Has Risen from the Grave are available on Blu-ray in the US only for rather cheap, so I need to get my mitts on those pronto.
That's because Warner Brothers owns those. So.
Yeah.
And they're a little better. They've been putting out the few Hammer titles they own, they've been putting out on Blu-ray, and then Columbia owns a bunch, basically Sony, and they've licensed those to Mill Creek, and Mill Creek is putting out these Blu-ray double features of stuff like, yes, the Gorgon and some of their noirs and their thrillers, like their non-supernatural horror thrillers.
They've got Revenge of Frankenstein, like Curse of the Mummy's Tomb, Two Faces, Doctor. I have some of the Mill Creek ones. I saw Revenge of Frankenstein on there,
yeah,
which is an interesting one.
I have a weird history with the Hammer stuff because I'll buy it on DVD. I'll be the first to buy it, and then I'll watch it and go, it's not as good as I remember. Or the ones I didn't like when I was a kid, I'll actually like today. And then the ones I loved as a kid are boring to me today. It's a strange, you know, and maybe it's just whatever I appreciated about them as a child. It just isn't evident anymore. Or they just.
Well, I remember we did on the show a while back, like Brides of Dracula or something.
Yeah, we did Brides of Dracula.
And we were kind of like, you know.
Yeah,
we
I loved it when I was a teenager. Yeah, I
remember y'all, I had never seen it, and y'all were going, oh, this movie's great. And then when we watched it, when we were talking about it, we were kind of going,
Yeah, what happened? It's strange. It's it is unique. Like The Mummy with Christopher Lee, I never liked when I was a kid. I thought it was the bad mummy movie in color when I was a child, and then when I watched it as an adult, I'm like, oh, this is pretty good. I see what it's doing.
Yeah, it's good. It's good.
The Sherlock Holmes English type of thriller, the Conan Doyle type of thriller, and it works. But when I was a kid, I didn't appreciate that about it. I thought The Mummy moved too fast, and you know, it was weird, you know, because I was comparing it to the Universal stuff.
I saw it for the first time not too long ago and thought it was pretty good.
Yeah.
In the box set, I have got Frankenstein and the Monster from Hell. I've never seen it. What's that one like?
That was disappointing when I finally saw it, because I grew up seeing the pictures in a magazine of the David Prowse looking like a gorilla monster or something. Mm. And when I got the Paramount DVD, I think it debuted in the Walmart $5 bin. I went out, bought it, had to find it at a specific Walmart in town because you couldn't just order stuff off Amazon like you can now. And watched it, and I was like, oh, wow, that really wasn't worth all the wait in anticipation for. But who knows, I might watch it today and think it's pretty good. I have no idea. You don't know how you're gonna take it.
Okay.
Yeah, it's kind of funny how that works with especially with Hammer movies, because I remember watching some in college and thinking they were rad, and then revisiting them and going,
it's true.
Some that I thought were boring were really good.
Honestly, when I watched this 20 years ago, when I got the Anchor Bay VHS, I didn't care for it. But I liked it when I was a kid, when I saw it on TBS, like back in 79 or 80. And I thought it was good. So I watching it just today, I thought, oh, this is pretty good. So they have the weirdest effect, these Hammer films. It's strange. There's no other studio that makes movies that I'll hate. 10 years later, I'll like. 10 years later, I'll hate it again. And then 10 years later, I like it again. It's the weirdest thing.
Are they still doing the Hammer Shell Corporation movies, like where they kind of revived the brand?
Woman in Black, I think, was their only hit that I'm aware of. I know they did some movie with Hilary Swank. I don't know if they're still.
They did they did a few of them. Woman in Black was the only one that did well, I think.
Right.
But, you know, and
Conjuring,
I've watched
it. I think they did that. I think they did.
Did they? Okay.
I believe. But, you know, they made a similar announcement for Shaw Brothers. They constantly would do that, would say, they're bringing Shaw Brothers movies back. That's like, it's not the same thing. It's not
the
studio
not.
And the sound stages.
It's just the brand. That's all it is. You know, I saw a little bit of The Woman in Black, and I thought it did kind of, you know, try to recreate the Hammer aesthetic and cast actors that, you know, you might see in a Hammer movie today, but it's not a Hammer movie. It's not the studio. It's not all that aesthetic. I mean, that paradigm as we know it is way past dead, you know, the studio aesthetic.
Yeah. You don't get those sound stages because that's how they made movies back then. You don't get the great costumes and that type of cinematography. Movies don't have that type of color anymore. You know,
you don't have movies made by a team that constantly work together. So you have that brand where the films feel the same. I mean, you kind of have it in stuff like Marvel, but not in a good way.
No, you got very corporate movies where if you get something directed by Terrence Fisher, it's definitely got Terrence Fisher's point of view in the film.
Oh yeah, absolutely. But yeah, no, doing these movies is fun, though. And especially, I'm a big fan of the Frankenstein ones. The only one I haven't seen is Horror of Frankenstein, which I think is the one without Peter Cushing.
Yeah, that's that is the first Hammer film I remember watching. Oh, wow. I was like 5 years old back then. To watch this stuff, of course, no VCRs. You had to get up in the middle of the night to watch them. Mm-hmm. And I think my mother allowed me to get up at like 1 o'clock in the morning and watch it on the UHF channel. And she got up with me and watched it. And of course, it was pretty lame. You know, even then, I thought it was kind of dumb. But
yeah, it's not well thought of these days.
Although I have a fondness for it because it was the first one I saw. So every time a new video edition is available, I'll watch it. And I think I've seen only the British import version of it back when it was a PAL VHS. And I still had kind of the same opinion. But every time it's re-released on home video, I feel like a lot of these, I have to watch it again to see what I think of it. You know,
I just picked up on Blu-ray last week for $8.
And see, I'll probably buy the damn thing. I'll probably import it from Australia just to look at it again. It's weird.
We'll get moving because it's going pretty cheap at the moment. I think it is literally about $8 at the moment.
So I'm going to go on old JB Hi-Fi and get my PayPal up and work it with corporations.
You know. Corporations being all corporation-y.
Yeah. I wonder if he was the first guy to start the corporation talk. And made
I don't
it
know,
so
could be.
Yeah, even though corporations signal left so much these days.
Oh, the corporate, yeah, they're all communists. I mean, it's ridiculous that people think that right wing. It's
just, you know that a corporation is hurting, is about to go out of business when they go full commie and start you know, signaling like
they have their PR department just wreck their brand entirely.
Marvel is next. I feel it.
Yeah. Oh yeah. I'm waiting. I'm waiting. I want it to happen. I'm sitting here holding my hands.
Save movie culture. I tell you what, seeing four film noirs, classic film noirs from the 40s on the big screen over the weekend really, you know, clarify my perspective on films. Yeah, they're not as good as they used to be.
No.
Like seeing those on the big screen was an experience. It's like, okay, why are movies not involving me?
Listen,
like
this is sort of a different, this is a totally different genre, but my fiance took me to see Guys and Dolls at the theater with Brando. And I was sitting there going, this production is astounding. You know, it is such an experience to behold. And there's nothing like this today. And even when movies try to do it, like La La Land, they miss the point. You know, they don't like, you know, we went to see La La Land and my fiance is a musical, you know, that's her genre. And she was saying, oh my gosh, it's just, I don't go to a musical to see this pathos on screen. You know, it's supposed to be escapism and it's not.
Do me a favor and ask Amy if she likes, Can't Stop the Music.
No, she's seen it, but I'll ask her. She's seen a lot of like kind of the weird off the beaten track stuff. So yeah.
Or, what was that other one? Fuck, what was the other one that was about the apple? That was the other one. That was horrible.
Ooh.
That was rough.
Yeah.
Oh, but Kiss Beats the Phantom of the Park.
Movies are all post-production nowadays. That's the reason you don't get that.
Mm. You know. Yeah, totally. They're all done in computers and stuff.
Yeah, it's like, we'll fix that in editing. I think that's everything.
Like I heard Ready Player One could like qualify for an animation Oscar.
Oh, God.
That looks so bad.
I've got to go to see that next week with the kids. They've been asking me. So, because it was either that or Black Panther. I'm like, oh, we'll go see this Player One movie instead. I don't want your kids
getting
more comfort.
You're like, we're going to go see Ready Player One.
Yeah. Oh, yeah. I'm not going to go watch.
I am weirdly interested in Ready Player One. It looks bad, but to me, that movie is like, the plot looks like where we are culturally, you know?
Yeah.
Where the world sucks and everybody's just like plugged into this, you know, this virtual world, getting their, you know, their reward systems activated constantly.
The only reason why I'm mildly curious to see it is because I'm hoping it might be like Tron a bit, which I do enjoy Tron quite a bit. So if it's along those lines, I'll probably be able to get into it somewhat. If it's not,
you know, if you see it and if I go see it, you know, we should do a show on it.
Let's not get ahead of ourselves, but
I'm just saying.
Yeah. I mean, if it warrants a discussion, by all means. But if it's a stink fest,
if it's a stink fest, all the more. You know, we can talk about.
Yeah, why. True. Yeah, that's a good point.
You know, that's kind of where my mind's at.
Yeah.
If they got the rights to Ultraman, I would have seen it opening day.
I noticed Mobile Suit Gundam is in it. So
they tried for Ultraman, but that's part of a trademark suit in Japan that's gone on for decades.
I still need to see that movie, Ultraman. I've never seen it.
Which one?
Ultraman.
Ultraman, the TV show, the Japanese TV show.
No, I'm thinking of the Super.
You think of Inframan, the Shaw Brothers.
Yeah, Inframan. I get them mixed
up. Inframan's awesome. We did a show on that. That was good.
That's why I want to see it. You twat. That's why I'm interested in it. But I've never seen it. But I do want to see it, but I've just... I need a Blu-ray of it kicking around, but it's like, $40-odd. Like, I can't take that punt. Not at 40.
Yeah, there's a Hong Kong Blu-ray. There's going to be an 88 Films Blu-ray released in England, so that would probably be cheaper.
Yeah, I'll see if I can maybe do a rental on it off of iTunes. I think they have it on there. I might just do that for a couple of bucks.
Yeah, they might. They're good about having the English tracks on those, as I'm told. So,
what's the best way to watch that film though? In its original language, Japanese or English dub?
I would watch the English dub. The English dub is done by the New York team that did Speed Racer.
Oh, okay.
And I think they did a great job of kind of making it very palatable for global audiences. To English speaking audiences, they had a lot of fun with it.
Okay. All right. Well, you guys got anything else about Frankenstein Created Woman? What was the reason why you chose this one, Hunter? Out of all the Frankenstein films you got?
Well, first off, it was one we all had that we could watch, but I chose it because I think it's one of the more interesting Frankenstein movies in the series because it deals with metaphysical aspects with the soul, and it's not your typical Frankenstein movie where it's about like reanimating dead flesh. It's about it's Dr. Frankenstein, him going, I need to, retain the being of a person and, see if I can transplant it into another. I mean, it's a little bit just like switching brains, but I thought it was an interesting tack for it to take. And to me, that and Frankenstein Must Be Destroyed are the two like most memorable ones out of the series. And I like all of the movies with Cushing. I mean, on some level or another.
I did learn one thing from this film, though, was that... me personally, I've got dark hair most of the time. But I did learn, if I go into a hibernation of some sort and sleep for about, say, 6 months, my hair will go blonde all of a sudden. Yeah, I don't know how they got around that one. It makes no sense.
Yeah, the odd thing is this is Martin Scorsese's favorite Hammer film.
Oh, really?
Yeah.
It's probably and with Hunter being so interested in it because of the metaphysics and everything, I'm saying it must be kind of made for the Catholic leaning audience members.
No, that's definitely probably not inaccurate.
And it was probably just a natural progression for the script writers because the previous Frankenstein movies, like Curse of Frankenstein, he basically put the body of an insane person into the creature's body, and the creature was just not mentally there, so this would have been his attempt to actually have a functioning human being as the monster.
Yeah, like what one thing about the Hammer ones is they always tried to do something different with it. It wasn't just, I'm reanimating another Boris Karloff again. It was Frankenstein was going, okay, now I'm just going to switch the brains. Now I'm going to transport the soul. And then like there's the last one, Frankenstein, the monster from hell. He's in a prison and he makes this like bizarre ape monster. They just took different roads with it. They didn't try to make the same movie twice. I mean, Evil of Frankenstein is definitely a tribute to the Universal stuff, but even that one stands out as a tribute to the Universal stuff. So,
yeah. And, well, I was thinking I must have been super into these as a kid, even though with no home video and everything, I must have been reading the famous monsters a lot because we, when I was like 8 or 9 years old, the family went to the Wax Museum in San Francisco, the Hollywood Wax Museum, and we walked up to the wax statue of Walt Disney.
Did they have its head on or not?
Yeah, they had the head on. Okay. We had already seen all the guillotine wax dummies and the torture victims. Like, it was the most gruesome thing to take kids to. And they had like Al Capone and John Dillinger. And we go up to the statue of Walt Disney And my sister, who's like probably 4 years old at the time, said, "Who is that?" And, you know, my mother said, "Oh, that's Walt Disney." She says, "Well, it looks like Peter Cushing." And so it was like, I must have talked about Peter Cushing a lot when I was a kid. So, and we were all kind of stunned that she even said that. It's like, I must have, you know, been reading the Famous Monsters. And I know I had the, like, the 1975 edition that had Hammer Horror on the cover. And it had, like, Christopher Lee and Peter Cushing and the monsters and everything on the cover. As drawn by Basil Gogos or whoever.
Well, so what do we want to rate this? I'll go first. I give this one an 8 out of 10. Highly recommended for me. Right. Stuart, what about you?
I will give this a 7.5, and I'll say do it as a double feature with Frankenhooker.
Yes. Want a date?
That movie. Hen and Lotter.
Yeah, Hen and Lotter's. Yeah, he's kind of a sketchy dude. What about you, John?
I give it a 7.
Yep.
Because there's better Hammer movies for my money.
Oh, later. Yeah, for sure. There are.
Like, there's better. Hound of the Baskervilles. I think their version with Cushing is Sherlock Holmes is great.
Yeah, and I like Devil Rides Out quite a bit.
Yeah,
like,
that's a good one.
Yeah, I gotta get the Blu-ray.
Paranoiac with Oliver Reed, that's a good one.
I still haven't seen that. Curse of the Werewolf is a big favorite. Horror of Dracula. I like Curse of Frankenstein actually more than this. But, you know.
Oh really? Yeah. Oh, no, yeah. Curse of Frankenstein's very good. I like it a lot. Christopher Lee plays the monster in that one.
Hey, Hannah, did you say Paranoiac?
Yeah.
I think they just got released here as well on Blu-ray.
Oh. Just, okay, we gotta do that one on the show sometime.
I'll double check. Just bear with me.
Yeah, I've got that. It's a Universal set.
Yep, right? Yep. It's in that Universal, that Eternal Universal set. That's
so watch it. Captain Clegg or Night Creatures, whatever title it's under, is a great one. It's the Scarecrow Romney Marsh without the Scarecrow mask. And God, there's a lot of good. I even like Legend of the Seven Golden Vampires a great deal.
Just yeah, we'll do that. We got to do that one on the show sometime because it's such a crossover.
You know? Well, yeah, and it's also unique because it's David Chang's real voice, and which you never got to hear in any movie, no matter what language you got to watch it in.
It's like that meme, Infinity War is the greatest crossover of all time, and it's like,
bullshit.
So like seven Golden Vampires.
I'm going to go see a fucking Love Boat of Marvel movies.
Oh, I know. It's I hope that's their – you know, I hope that's their Heaven's Gate, but doubtful.
Oh yeah, I wish. We all thought Black Panther was going to be that, and it's like the most successful Marvel movie domestically.
Well, and I think the media really kind of pushed, it gave a lot of free advertising to it by pushing it so hard, you know.
Oh yeah, well that, and also it's far less radical when you actually see it.
It's everybody.
It's just a fucking James Bond movie with you know, African actors or actors doing African accents.
Based African communism, you know.
That's all it does. It's like, it's nothing. It's like, it's no big deal. But everybody who's never seen a movie outside of Tom Cruise stuff and, you know, thinks it's great.
All right, boys.
Wakanda! Jesus
Christ.
Anyway, well, anything else, guys, before we wrap it up?
Well, let us know what your favorite Hammer movies are. Yeah, do you have the same problem a middle-aged man like me has, where you love it, 10 years later you hate it, 10 years later you love it again? So, I don't know.
Let us know in the comments or on Facebook, or email us at midnightmoviecowboys.com, midnightmoviecowboys.com. Like and subscribe on iTunes. That really... We appreciate that,
yeah,
my friends.
And the screeches in the group, I'm weeding you out. You've exposed yourself, so you're out of there shortly. By the time you hear this, you'll be gone.
Yeah, we can't take chances anymore.
Nope.
And, extreme vetting.
Screeches, yeah. Grow up.
We need to come up with questions.
Yeah.
To join the...
Yeah.
Might be necessary.
All right, boys. We'll call it a day.
All righty, everybody. Well, if that's it, I'm going to go ahead and say adios.
And I will say, down with the corporations. There you go. We'll be right back.
Thank you for listening to the Midnight Movie Cowboys. For more information, go to www.midnightmoviecowboys.com. For feedback, comments, or show suggestions, go to midnightmoviecowboys@gmail.com. Like what you hear? Head on over to iTunes and leave us a review. Hear us on Stitcher Radio. Head over to stitcher.com and download the app. Want to help the show out? Head on over to www.midnightmoviecowboys.com and hit the PayPal donate. We appreciate all donations of any denomination. Find us on Twitter at MMCowboys. Like us on Facebook. Head over to facebook.com. Type in Midnight Movie Cowboys. Hit the like button over there. Want to friend us personally on Facebook or follow us on Twitter? Go to www.midnightmoviecowboys.com and find the links from there on the right-hand side. Thanks for listening. See you all next week.